You are listening to Climate Now. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm James Lawler. And on today's episode, we'll be discussing voluntary carbon offset markets. So as the world looks to 2050 as the drop-dead date for achieving net zero emissions, more and more companies, organizations, and countries have announced their plans to achieve net zero. And most of these plans include some form of carbon offsets.
But in order for these carbon offsets to be an effective part of these plans, the market where we're buying them is going to have to work. So today we're going to investigate those markets. How do they function? How well do they actually work? What are the problems that we should be looking out for, and how can we possibly solve them, or at least get ahead of them? Today we have two guests to help us explore these questions. Derek Brokoff, he's a senior scientist with the Stockholm Environment Institute and former vice president of policy at Climate Action Reserve, which is a carbon offset registry. Also joining us is Mark Trexler, who is the director of climate change knowledge systems at the Climatographers. He was a chapter editor on carbon accounting and carbon offsets for the IPCC Special Report on Land Use and Land Use Change, and he holds a PhD in International Environmental Policy from UC Berkeley. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Derek, Mark, we like to ask all of our guests the same question first. How did you get where you are? Mark, let's start with you, and Derek, I'd love to also have you jump in.
I still blame my 11th grade high school ecology teacher for this situation, and have sort of been on this path for quite a while. I ended up doing my graduate work on the international wildlife trade, and had actually applied for a position in the biodiversity program at the World Resources Institute, where I ended up, but got hired into the energy program to work on the first carbon offset. And basically have been here ever since.
So you worked on the first carbon offset?
Correct, in 1988.
Very cool. And how about you, Derek? Tell us your story.
Yeah, so as was noted earlier, I'm with the Stockholm Environment Institute, where I've been for about 6 years, working on a variety of questions related to climate policy, including carbon offsets. Before that, as also noted at the Climate Action Reserve, helping to develop the standards under that program, in particular in the lead up to their transition into the California Cap and Trade program. And then going back even further, had a stint at WRI, the World Resources Institute, on their greenhouse gas protocol team, working on accounting questions related to climate change mitigation projects, including carbon offsets. And I got entree to that position in part because, going even further back, I was one of Mark's earlier employees in his firm that was advising companies on climate strategy back in the 1990s, and in particular, strategies related to carbon offsets.
Derek, what is the definition of a carbon offset?
Yeah, right. So in the most generic sense, carbon offset is the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, or a reduction in the emissions of greenhouse gases that is used to compensate for emissions that are occurring somewhere else. So what happens is a buyer of a carbon offset will have a certain target, let's say, for reducing their emissions, or they have some amount of emissions that they simply cannot reduce themselves, but they want to get to a level of net zero emissions. So they go out and they pay other parties to reduce emissions or take CO2 out of the atmosphere, and then they claim that reduction or that removal against their own greenhouse gas emissions. The catch here is that in order for that kind of claim to be valid, right, there has to be a causal connection between your paying someone else to reduce emissions or remove CO2 and that reduction or removal actually happening.
Why do we care that companies make this distinction between a carbon offset and other kinds of carbon removal that are perhaps still beneficial, but that don't quite meet the offset standard?
Part of it's truth in advertising. So when a company represents itself as carbon neutral, What they're saying is that their net contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions is zero. And if that's premised on the idea that you've paid someone else to reduce emissions and they were going to reduce those emissions anyway, that's not a valid argument, right? Emissions would have been the same had you not paid someone to reduce emissions. And so, you know, what's left is just whatever you're emitting. There's no validity to the idea that your net contribution is zero. The other piece of it is just the opportunity cost, right? So if you pay someone to do something they were going to do anyway, you could have instead reduced your own emissions and caused an absolute reduction in emissions. Or you could have paid someone to remove carbon or reduce emissions that in a way that's truly additional. That actually would result in a lower level of greenhouse gas emissions globally.
So I have another definition I'd love to discuss, net zero. And Mark, you have quite a long history with this one. I'd love to understand, are people even using it as intended? Are we using it correctly?
The key thing here is that net zero really started as sort of a, how are we going to get to 1.5 degrees? Or how are we going to get to 2 degrees? How quickly do we need to reduce global emissions to achieve those goals? And under most of the pathways, there's a point at which you have to get to net zero in order to stop at 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. And so then what happened is this is sort of this idea that, well, let's all do this. You know, instead of figuring out the public policies needed to get us to net zero, somehow we came up with the idea that individuals and companies should all be doing net zero. And that sort of in the last 2 years, that's where the conversation has gone. But it really started out as a societal thing where it makes a lot more sense.
What you just said there, Mark, reminds me of something that you, Derek, mentioned in advance of this interview, this notion of a fallacy of division, which is the false idea that what's true for the whole must be true for some or all of its parts. And in the case of net zero, it'd be like saying, if we need to become net zero as a civilization, then every single company should go net zero. It sounds pretty logical at first, right? But why is this actually problematic thinking?
Yeah, so as Mark was saying, you know, what the science suggests is that globally, we need to get to net zero emissions by the middle of the century. And by the way, the science also suggests that towards the latter half of the century, we actually have to go negative. So there is going to be this essential role for negative emission technologies going forward. But this is a global analysis, right? And if you look at, well, how do we distribute and allocate the responsibility for reducing and removing emissions around the world, there are equity considerations that come into play. So, you know, sharing the burden, who's most responsible historically for those emissions and who is best able to pay for the mitigation or the removals. That's one piece of the question. And the other is, you know, when we talk about there being what's called residual emissions, you know, the emissions that remain by the middle of the century that we need to compensate with removals, really we're only finding those in certain sectors. So heavy industry, cement, metals, chemicals, for example, just by the nature of the production technologies we have there, there are some portion of those, the emissions that they create, that will be very hard to reduce, very costly. We'll have to come up with new technologies. So those industries are the ones that are contributing to the emissions that we'll need to net out at the end of the day. But the vast majority of other companies in different sectors, businesses around the world, shouldn't be focusing on net zero. They should be focusing on getting to zero emissions. And that's where this idea of net zero, although it's certainly a valid idea at the global level, if you translate it literally down to the level of individual companies, it can be a distraction.
Can I just add something to that? In the context of your recent podcast on net zero, where it was sort of described what the different pathways are for the US to get to net zero, think of that differently. If every company, and of course the problem here is that not every company does this. So, you know, you have 10% of companies deciding to become net zero, for example, but they can't actually control where they get their electricity necessarily. They can't, there's a lot about the system that each individual company can't control at all. So they want to go out and buy offsets to get to net zero. But the net zero that you're sort of accomplishing through the individual efforts, as Derek was saying, is entirely different from the net zero that we're talking about at a societal level in terms of electrifying the economy, et cetera. And so that is a key thing, that these two ideas are quite different.
I'd like to take a quantitative look at the carbon offset market today. What is the global demand for offsets? How many tons of CO2 are we talking about here? And what does the demand curve look like for the last 10 years or so? And can we, you know, can we project where it's going?
Yeah, we do. I mean, you know, a decade ago, we were in the millions of tons a year. I mean, maybe 10 to 15 million. So a pretty small number. Today, maybe in the 100 million a ton range for voluntary offsets. And you know, people are talking about we need to up this to 2 or 3 billion. So we're talking about a radical expansion of the markets from where they are today.
And what does the supply look like with current projects that are on offer? You know, is supply meeting demand? Do we think that supply can meet demand?
You know, supply historically hasn't been the issue. If you're talking about getting billions of tons into a voluntary market, supply does become the issue. But here's where the additionality becomes key, especially when you're talking about carbon removals a la forestry and soils and all the areas that people are so excited about. You know, hundreds of billions of tons of carbon circulate between the atmosphere and the oceans and the soils and the forests every year, just totally naturally. And so if we start saying, okay, we're going to give everybody credit for a lot of these tons that are cycling naturally, we're not actually doing anything additional. But the potential supply side for non-additional offsets is almost infinite. And that's what makes this so challenging, because we only need a relatively small number compared to that. But that requires the really difficult process of differentiating between additional and non-additional.
Derek, do you have any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the big challenge going forward if you want to scale these markets. I guess somewhat on the flip side, right? Let's imagine some generic test that screens out, you know, 90% of the non-additional tons, but you have a really small market and 10% of non-additional tons could take up a good portion of the demand in that market. If you really scale these markets up, then that 10% may not be as big a deal. And so part of how you balance these trade-offs between getting, you know, false positive results, you know, certifying projects that aren't really additional, it, you know, relates to how big the market's going to be.
Derek, there's this really interesting report from Greenpeace that was published in January of 2021. Title is Net Expectations: Assessing the Role of Carbon Dioxide Removal in Companies' Climate Plans. Quite a mouthful, but we'll have a link to a copy of the report in our show notes for those of you who want to check it out. But there is a quote that I really want to read, because I think it underscores why it would be problematic to have every company go net zero. The IPCC reports that the maximum sustainable CO2 removal in 2050 by new forests is somewhere between 500 and 3,600 million tons per year. The maximum for BECCS is between 500 and 5,000 million tons. However, since they compete for land, these potentials cannot simply be added to each other. To put these in perspective, ENI and International Airlines Group each anticipate using forests to offset 30 million tons per year of CO2 by 2050. Just these two companies could thus exhaust up to 12% of the available total. It seems like the problem is very clearly outlined. I mean, Derek, isn't essentially this the point that you're trying to make? That, like, not only does it not make sense, but quite literally, it won't work?
Exactly. And this is part of the problem of the framing, I suppose. Like, even in this conversation, we've been talking a lot about removing CO2 from the atmosphere. And for years and years, when we talked about carbon offsets, we were talking primarily, I would say, about emission reductions, that is, paying someone else to reduce emissions in order to compensate for your own carbon footprint. And this, the net zero framing, arguably, there's been a big uptick in interest in the last couple of years in removal offsets, And the figure you just quoted there is a manifestation of that, an example of how companies that normally might think of offsetting their emissions through other kinds of emission reductions are now focused on removals, so much so that stated commitments of several companies would eat up huge portions of the total potential we have globally for actually removing CO2 from the atmosphere.
So then what's your take on what needs to be done here? How do we redirect these companies or entities who have already made these bold net zero pronouncements that are just really unrealistic in terms of our actual storage potential?
Yeah, it's arguably a big misallocation of resources, right? If you look globally right now today, what we need are emission reductions and more emission reductions. And the marginal benefit of reducing fossil fuel carbon emissions in terms of both climate change mitigation, but also environmental and health benefits, or of avoiding deforestation, the marginal benefits there are much greater than, say, taking CO2 and storing it in rock formation somewhere. So this sort of concept that we have of net zero, and that means balancing our emissions with removals, while it's useful, I think, as a sort of benchmark for where we need to get globally, and particularly valuable in terms of communicating that zero part, it's created this, again, a fallacy of division, a misplacement of priorities in terms of where the investment really needs to go today.
So, Mark, can you tell us how this concept of additionality, meaning the direct monetary investment into activities that will sequester more carbon from the atmosphere than would have happened otherwise, how this concept helps to differentiate between a carbon good deed, let's call it, and a true carbon offset?
Well, it's really challenging, because to differentiate between good deeds and carbon offsets, you almost have to get inside the head of the person carrying out the action to decide why they did something. And we can't do that. So we have to come up with other ways of figuring out, is something additional or not additional. And we can never know for sure. We never can know with absolute certainty whether something is additional or not. So the idea that we have these standards that decide this is additional or not is sort of misleading from the get-go. And in reality, there's a continuum from, yeah, we can have a lot of confidence, to no, we don't have much confidence in this at all. But the standards have evolved so it is yes, no. And so that's why you have this wide range of quality, but people are able to sell offsets as if they were all the same. There are constant exposés about projects that are obviously not additional, and yet they got through one registry or another, which is one reason that the price of offsets is $2, $5, $10. Now you do have some carbon removal projects that are hundreds of dollars, but that's an incredibly small slice of the market. But it's partially because there are so many bad projects that pricing in the market is so low that it's hard to imagine it accomplishes much.
So if there are so many bad projects, how can we be confident in the current certification approach? I'd love to hear you both talk about the problems with certification and sort of having a pass-fail system and this necessity of having an accessible, transparent marketplace. Is that even something that we can get to?
Right. The question is, for any removal of CO2, is that a removal that would have happened anyway in the absence of a voluntary carbon market? Or is it actually occurring because of the incentive provided by the market? And that's the crux of the issue. Like, how you determine or come up with an answer to that question is fundamental to the integrity of this market. And it's easier for some types of activities than for others. There are some types of mitigation activities where you're talking about capturing and destroying industrial waste gases, for example. There's no regulation requiring that. There's no other revenue stream associated with those activities. You can be fairly confident it's additional, that they wouldn't be doing this if they weren't getting the revenue from the carbon credits. For a whole bunch of other activities, it's a much grayer kind of question. So if you're going into an individual project and trying to parse out, Do I think this is a project that would have happened in the absence of the market, or do I think it's truly responding to these incentives? That's a really tricky question to answer. The carbon offset programs, the ones certifying these credits, arguably are, I used to be at one. They do their best. They come up with methods and standards, criteria for trying to separate the non-additional from the additional. And they do a much better job than, would probably happen if those standards did not exist. But, nobody can do that perfectly. And that's, going back to a paper Mark and I wrote years and years ago, that's, one of the challenges of this market is you can never be 100% confident. There's no test for additionality that's going to be 100% effective. And so you kind of have to look at the big picture in any kind of market like this, like, where do you draw the line? Where do you set the criteria based on what your overall objectives are? It's easy to do in a policy context. It's hard to do in a voluntary market where, every buyer wants a bulletproof ton, which is just not realistic.
One thing that tends to happen is that the first project of a particular kind that comes in, that project might actually be additional. But then once that methodology is approved and the way of looking at that project is approved, then projects that come behind it are likely to get approved as well. And so as soon as you see a new methodology or a new kind of project, you can go out and start looking for all the good deed projects that look very similar to that project and try and get them into the market. And so that's one thing that happens a lot. You start with something additional, but then people try and say, oh, well, I can make some money if I can get all these good deeds into the market. And suddenly you've got huge volumes of good deed offsets that started with a good project.
Got it. And at the end of the day, in spite of the issues we've faced so far with implementation, is it safe to assume that, yes, we should have some kind of marketplace to allow companies to purchase offsets in general? Or would you disagree with that?
I might actually push back on that a little bit, not because I think offset markets are inherently bad, but, Einstein had a quote to the effect that we can't solve problems with the same tools that got us into the problem in the first place. And that's what we're talking about here. And a key point is that we have basically been ignoring climate change for 30 plus years. Climate risk is actually quite a bit more substantial than most people realize. And there's a big question as to, is this the time to start doing a lot more voluntary stuff as opposed to figuring out how we rapidly transition to net zero at a societal level? And voluntary offset markets are not going to accomplish that transition pretty much at all. And given where we are today and the climate crisis, it's not just, well, can offset markets be good? Because they can. But is it the right tool for the crisis that we're currently in is a much more difficult question.
But to make sure I understand your point, Mark, offset markets exist in order to allow organizations, individuals, companies to purchase offsets and one by one become net zero. But that's not sufficient to get us as a society to net zero.
I mean, two things. Only 10% of companies are ever going to go net zero globally. It's not as if 100% of companies or even anything remotely close to 100% of companies will go net zero voluntarily. And so you've got the fact that not everybody's going to do it. And companies acting individually can't make the things happen that we actually need to happen to get society to net zero in terms of large scale electrification, et cetera. That takes centralized policy.
Yeah, if I might chime in, slightly devil's advocate, but I think pretty much in line with Mark saying, I get it's a truism in climate policy that there's no such thing as a silver bullet. What we need is silver buckshot. That is, we have to kind of throw everything in the kitchen sink at the climate change problem. And in that context, I do think there's a role for the voluntary carbon market. But the question is how to leverage that market, that sort of demand out there, the willingness of companies to make these investments, harness that in a way that actually, best leverages it towards collective climate ambitions. So building it into the regime that we're, at least envisioning under the Paris Agreement, and incorporate it in a way that it can help countries for example, to raise their ambition going forward. Because, you know, if you look around at what countries have committed to under the Paris Agreement, it's still far short of what we need to avoid dangerous climate change and achieve the stated goals of the Paris Agreement. So I think there's a role for the voluntary market, even if it's just these 10% of companies who want to go net zero. If they're willing to step up and make those investments, that's a great thing. We just need to find a way to channel that investment to where it's going to be most beneficial to deal with these additionality questions, for example. But, you know, maybe not focus so much on, have I as an individual company got my own carbon footprint covered here, but rather, what am I contributing to collective action on climate change? And I think if we can reframe things a little bit that in that direction, there could be a really positive role for the market going forward.
Okay, so let's say that though the voluntary carbon offset market isn't the silver bullet that we need, there is some utility for it, and there's clearly a need to improve the quality of the product, namely ensuring the validity and additionality of these credits themselves. Mark, could you talk us through a couple of approaches that might help to fix these markets?
Well, one of the key issues that we got into a little bit earlier was just that the quality of offsets is on a continuum from low quality to high quality. And yet, once you're certified as an offset, once you've gotten your project validated, you can claim to be as good as anyone else. And that's a real problem, because then everybody goes for the cheapest stuff and you end up in a race to the bottom of quality. What I've long advocated, and what we're actually starting to see now in terms of several startups in this space, is that we need something equivalent to a scoring system so that buyers can know whether they're buying, you know, a AAA or an 800 out of 1,000 versus a 200 out of 1,000. And the 200 and 800 aren't actually telling you, yes, this is a good offset, or no, this is not a good offset. It's saying, how confident can you be in the quality of this offset? And if we had that, then buyers would actually, there would be some pressure on buyers to buy quality, not just to buy on price and to get the lowest cost thing. And it's encouraging that there are sort of two or three initiatives that I'm aware of out there where people are trying to come up with that kind of rating system so that buyers would have a lot more information about where on this quality continuum their offsets are or could be, because maybe the market is able to then pick itself up by its bootstraps from a quality perspective.
Why would any company want to be the one to buy the cheaper, lower quality offset? If we switch to a rating system, why not just buy less of the more expensive but better offsets?
Well, I mean, you're not saying that the project isn't additional. So let's differentiate, for example, between a 600 project and a 900 project, just to keep it simple numerically. You know, the 900 project might be turning CO2 into rock. And for that, you're going to pay $750 a ton. The 600 project, which is still you can have a reasonable amount of confidence in that project. Maybe that project is available for $30. So, you know, to say that you should only be buying $750 a ton offsets wouldn't make a lot of sense. And nobody's going to do that. I think what the scoring system would really make it much more difficult to do, though, is to be buying a lot of 150s score out of 1,000, because then it's clear that you're buying junk bonds, so to speak. And so a significant chunk of the offset supply is down in that 100, 200 range. And so, you know, even if not everybody is buying 900, getting people to buy 600 and 700 would be a huge step up from where we are today.
There's an effort underway right now called the Task Force for Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets, or TSVCM, which is started by a gentleman named Mark Carney, who happens to be a former governor of the Bank of England. And this organization has more or less the who's who in terms of, you know, people involved in climate, you know, climate organizations worldwide working together in some fashion on this massive effort. There are hundreds of names on this project's website. Derek, you in fact are listed on the website as some kind of advisor, you know, to the project. Could you tell us what this effort is all about and what you think it will produce?
to be clear, I'm part of an advisory committee, I guess, although committee seems like too small of a word. It's about 150 different stakeholders that have been engaged in advising this process to develop, I guess, a blueprint for how to scale the voluntary carbon markets. In a way, it's a sign of the times that the attention and urgency around climate change has generated this interest in scaling up the markets and finding a way to do that. And I don't in any way begrudge them their motivations here, right? It's an indication of the urgency of the problem. And, you know, the motivating idea behind it is to really grease the skids, to scale up investment in climate change solutions and make it easier for companies to do that. And to do it in a way that has integrity. So, you know, that's one of the topics that they're intent on addressing is how do you improve the integrity of these carbon credits? Now, I don't know that they've cracked that nut, but I think the sort of intention and the direction is headed, it's headed in the right direction in terms of envisioning something like what Mark was just talking about, like a scoring system or a gatekeeping role. It's yet to be determined what that really looks like. The big focus so far has been on, you know, creating a kind of market governance system and building a kind of umbrella body that would oversee the market, apply labels to carbon credits so you can better understand what you're getting as a buyer and allowing the market to scale up that way.
So billions of tons of carbon offsets are expected to be in demand in the future, which in dollars comes out to hundreds of billions of dollars, potentially, if not more. And the TSVCM is trying to capture that market. Derek, you just painted a semi-positive picture of this effort. So give us a sense of the challenges that this effort will face going forward. Will it work? Can it work? Should it work?
So the problem we have right now, and this is an issue that the task force has basically recognized but punted on, the problem we have is that every country in the world has now pledged to reduce emissions under the Paris Agreement, right? And this is a novel situation. Before the Paris Agreement, it was really just the industrialized countries that had made any kind of commitment to actually reducing emissions and tackling climate change. Now we're in a situation where if you go and invest in mitigation somewhere, whether that's emission reductions or removing CO2 from the atmosphere, there's a good chance that it's covered by one of these national pledges, that a national government somewhere has already pledged to make that reduction or make that removal. And so if you're going to try to claim that as an offset as a company, right, you're basically saying, well, but for my purchase of this carbon credit, that emission reduction would not have happened. But clearly, if these countries have made these pledges, I think, you know, we have to take them at their word. They're going to make good on those pledges. We're talking about mitigation that is, you know, going to happen anyway. And so the only way you can validly count that as an offset is to, you know, go to the government and basically say, hey, I want to claim this. Will you relinquish the claim that you're going to make under your nationally determined contribution, the pledge you've made under the Paris Agreement, and sort it out that way? Now, that's a big ask. And this is a huge debate within the voluntary carbon market right now, which I think is why the task force has decided to punt on it. People are arguing back and forth about whether they really need to go to the national governments to get you know, this accounting adjustment, basically. But I would say that without that, you don't have a valid offset. So there's two ways the market can go. One is to, like, you know, basically tap into this architecture that's being negotiated under the Paris Agreement for how countries can sort out these conflicting claims and avoid double counting the emission reductions. The alternative is to say, hey, you know, are offsets really what we need here, right? Is there anything really so magical about a carbon offset and becoming carbon neutral? Or is what's really valuable simply contributing to global efforts in addressing climate change? And so another model here is that a carbon credit wouldn't be an offset. It would simply represent, you know, a verified, certified ton of emission reductions that's contributing to a country's goals, but is not an offset to your own corporate emissions. And I would argue that that's actually, you can make the case for that being a more valuable contribution, right? A kind of investment. This is what I'm doing as a company to help collective efforts on climate change rather than, you know, I've got my own little neck of the woods covered with my own carbon footprint. But that's a huge shift in the paradigm for these markets. And it's one that I guess collectively we're all kind of working through right now, like how that might actually come about.
Well, thank you so much, Derek and Mark, for making this such a fascinating conversation and so illuminating. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is it for this episode of the podcast. You can check out other interviews, watch our videos, and sign up for our newsletter at climatenow.com. And if you want to get in touch with us, email us at contact@climatenow.com or tweet at us @WeAreClimateNow. We hope you'll join us for our next conversation.